hooker sits in the lobby of the Motel Astor. She has no idea what year it is, but only that she was murdered in room 115 during the mid-80s. Because that's the thing about the dead. The time frame of the mortal world becomes non-existent after death. Without the meaning of life, the sand in the hourglass becomes wet mud. The sex worker sparks a cigarette and inhales deeply. The angel in the lobby looks over to the man behind the desk and asks, "How long?" He kept his eyes on the television monitor, playing the same repeat of the All in the Family episode where Edith is sexually assaulted. The lobbyist finally replied, "What do you mean? How long do I have to stay in this piss-poor excuse of the Bates Motel?" The employee's eyes glance at her and he says, "When I was murdered in 1979, I remember I was sitting here watching poor Edith finally escape the sex offender's perverted grasp after smashing a hot cake in his face. This couple came into the lobby and asked me if I worship Satan. Upon telling them that Satan doesn't exist, the man made me get on my knees as his wife instructed. I perform oral sex on the barrel of his gun." He paused for a moment. He then pulled the trigger, and before I knew it, I've been stuck in this goddamn place watching Archie Bunker crack jokes about a punch bowl on an endless fucking loop, over and over and over again. The Motel Astor employee concluded with, "To answer your question, you'll be able to leave when I'm able to tune in to another goddamn television show." Dismay settled on the hooker's face, and after a momentary pause of failing to assess her purpose, she asked the worker if he even knew her name. After shaking his head, the prostitute said, "Figures. I feel as though I'm some side character in a horror tale that nobody cares about." She then takes a long drag of the cigarette and confesses, "My name is Susan Davenport, but to the rest of the world, I'm just a sample of a soul made to serve men for $50. But what you don't know is I'm more than that." "Oh, is that right?" the lobbyist asks, without any indication that he actually gave a fuck. "Yeah, that's right," Susan says. "At one point, I made my mom and my dad proud. I got all A's and was in the top of my graduating class." She laughs slowly. "And then one day I'm working on the side of Highway 70 at truck stops. It's like the entire world became my nightmare, and it smells of sex. And believe me, I lived every single day thinking it would get better. I used to think that I would die in a hospital bed as a happy old woman." She took one final puff of her cigarette and continued. "But instead, my throat was slashed at 28 years old in this godforsaken motel." "At least you weren't forced to eat shit in broken glass like the teenage girl in 111, the worker replied, trying to sound optimistic beneath a cloud of misery. Yeah, I'd rather be picked apart and eaten than made to consume poop until I died," she said. It is then that the All of the Family episode suddenly restarts, and the classic opening of the piano and the happy TV couple singing about better days can be overheard. A black tear from mascara forms in the corner of Susan's eyes, and she asks, "So tell me, what is the backstory of this motel? You know, the reason why it seems to devour people and spit them out." "You really want to know?" the lobbyist asks. Susan then lights up another cigarette and says, "Oh, don't tell me it was run by a man with mommy issues." She exhales smoke. "If I'm going to be trapped here for all eternity, at least let the reason be a good one, not some remake or serial killer cliche bullshit." The worker is silent for a moment and begins to reveal the history of the motel. Back in 1898, before the Motel Astor existed, and there was a Highway 70 that led victims to its despair, this property right here was a cornfield with a dirt road that cut through it. And just a couple miles away from this prosperous field was the town of Benson. By day, the township floated on the surface of its facade, where Southern baptism and good old country values blossomed like magnolia flowers. However, when the sun went down, teachers, firefighters, and other respected members of the community would join together in a dark society called the Fellowship of Caligula. Susan went quiet and then asked, "Do you mean a cult?" "Well, they called it a religious group. But yeah, a cult. A cult devoted to the late member of the House of Rulers, conventionally known as the Julio-Claudian Dynasty. They believed Caligula was not only a man of many gods, but the Christian god as well." The lobbyist then asked the ghostly prostitute for a cigarette and continued the sordid tale. Obviously, they were all nut jobs, but nobody in that time period ever questioned the possibility that an evil cult resided in the underbelly of the Bible Belt. One night, their leader purposed that they sacrifice the town simpleton, Josh Brannan, a mentally handicapped man who not only had the mind of a child, but he was still a virgin. He puffs on his cigarette for a moment. They stripped the man naked and paraded him to the cornfield, where they, too, stood nude in the pale moonlight. With nothing but black hoods over their heads, they nailed Joshua to a wooden cross and chanted, "God to son, son to the people to love, love to hate, hate to nails, nails to the crucifix to blood, blood to the devil, to the devil, to the devil." The man went silent for a second, and then noticed the look of horror on Susan's face. Little did the cult know that Joshua Brannan possessed the power of mind control, and his gift never came to light until they hung him from the crucifix. In a mixture of agony, humiliation, and absolute fear, in the middle of their morbid ritual, he made the members of Dark Society rip one another apart with their bare hands. Under his control, they tore off their limbs, jaws, and genitals. Hell, Joshua even made them disembowel the leader and eat her intestines. The prostitute's eyes grew big like a scared little girl. "Their blood soaked into the soil, and it left a stain that no rain can wash away, honey. And as for Joshua, his blood too, absorbed into the very dirt in which this motel stands on." The lobbyist then put out the cigarette and a cup of coffee. "Now, is that a good enough reason to you as to why the Motel Astor is such a horrible place?" Susan swallowed a tight lump and nodded her head slowly. "All right. Well, now that you know the marvelous history of the Holiday Inn," the lobbyist replied sarcastically, "I now have to go and feed Mr. McCormick in room 119. "Let me do it," the prostitute says. After a short pause of unenthusiastic surprise, the man asked, "And why do you want to do such a nasty task? You don't work here." Susan looked at him and replied in a rather defeated tone, "If I can't figure out my purpose, I might as well make one." The man behind the desk smiled and said, "Well, the hiring manager isn't able to confirm whether or not you can work here because he's hanging from a slipknot in his office. However, we are accepting applications." "Fuck you, I'll volunteer," she said. He then reached into a drawer and pulled out the key for room 119 and told her, "The dog food is in the dresser along with the funnel." She took the key, headed out of the lobby, and proceeded to Mr. McCormick's room. As she walked down the sidewalk, Susan passed a crying little girl who stood at the Coke machine. The child was wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt and with a fragile whimper asked, "Have you seen my mommy?" Susan smiled, but the depression in her voice was instant. "Oh, dollface, your mommy went crazy after you drowned in the swimming pool." The little girl was quiet for a few seconds and then asked, "Is she ever going to come back?" The dead hooker shook her head and said, "No, Janie, we've been over this before. Don't you remember? She blew her brains out a year later in Georgia." Susan then walked away from the girl and passed numerous doors before she arrived to 119. She used the key to unlock the door, and upon entering, was greeted by the smell of feces. She turned on the light where a man who had been tied to a bed was revealed. He had been strapped to the mattress for almost a year, and he had been eaten up with bed sores and infections, and his muscles had deteriorated. "Hello, Mr. McCormick," Susan said, walking over to the dresser. She pulled out a funnel and a can of Alpo and added, "I'm the new housekeeper." The man moaned something in agonizing bliss, and then she replied, "I'm sorry for what this motel has done to you." Mr. McCormick said nothing. In the pits of her hopelessness and endless days that dragged on and on, Susan realized that that was her purpose. Before she died, her father always told her, "When in hell, do as the hellions do." And with that, the hooker shoved the funnel of dog food into the helpless man's mouth and said, "It's time to eat." The year was 1991. Nate Sinclair entered the lobby of the Motel Astor, and the worker from behind the desk kept his eyes on the small TV monitor. The employee was watching the episode of All in the Family, where it's Edith's 50th birthday, and without looking directly at Nate, he said, "Hello, welcome to the Motel Astor. How may I help you?" "Yeah, I need a room for the night," he replied. The lobbyist glanced at Nate and, lacking any enthusiasm in his voice, said, "Well, we have an opening in room 213. The worker then pulled the room key from under the desk and slid it across the tabletop. After paying the deposit, Nate said, "Thanks. I've been driving from Delaware to Georgia, and let me tell you, the highway can take a bit of a toll on you." A facial expression of not really giving a shit remained evident on the lobbyist's face, and he replied, "Well, this place can take a toll on you as well." "Long night?" Nate asked with a happy-go-lucky smile on his face. However, his attempts to spark a sense of humor in the worker's face failed. "Yeah, something like that," the man behind the desk replied, paying more attention to the programming. Meanwhile, the fluorescent light above them flickered and the lobbyist added, "It seems as though I can never leave this place." A short silence fell between them, and he concluded by saying, "Enjoy your stay here." Nate then left the lobby with the key in his hand and proceeded to room 213. Before reaching the steps that headed to the upper level of the motel, he noticed a beautiful woman at the ice machine. She was blonde and rather angelic looking, and her hips fit into a pair of Daisy Dukes. Nate found the woman rather attractive, approached her and asked, "Has anyone ever told you that you look like Farrah Fawcett?" She blushed and replied, "Yeah, I've been told that before." The woman batted her blue eyes and asked, "I assume that's supposed to be a compliment, right?" "Well, of course," Nate exclaimed in his mind. Instead of verbally replying, though, he let out a small chuckle and nodded his head. After a momentary silence and savoring the connection between them, the woman told him that her name was Sandy. He extended out his hand and said, "It's nice to meet you." She returned the favor by lightly grasping his hand and cordially shaking it. "And your name is?" "Nate," he replied. "Ah, and what brings you here?" "Oh, well, my sister's getting married down in Georgia," he informed her. "I figured I would just, you know, stay the night and rest." Nate paused and then asked her the same question. There was a silence and Sandy's warm smile faded to indifference. She didn't say much other than she needed to get away. "Life just gets crazy, you know. It feels like every day is exactly the same," she said. Not knowing how to respond to that statement, Nate decided to change the topic of their small talk and asked, "What room are you staying in?" "Oh, I'm in 201, Sandy informed him. "Oh, cool. I'm staying in 213, so I'm pretty close." She laughed and began to walk up the steps. As Nate followed shortly behind her, Sandy replied, "I wish I could switch rooms. 201 smells really bad and the water's really nasty." When the two reached the second level, they turned and she added, "I've complained numerous times, but the management doesn't seem to do anything about it." Nate and Sandy then passed a couple of doors and he said, "Yeah, the service here seems a little shitty. Hell, that guy in the lobby didn't even act like he wanted to do his job." "Oh, him? His name is Mitch. Apparently he has worked here since the early 70s. And then she flipped her gorgeous rainbow of blonde hair and added, "Well, I couldn't really imagine anyone being happy with working here. I mean, it isn't really a five-star resort." This became evident to Nate when he passed the door of room 215 and could hear arguing from the other side. Apparently that's a couple who lives in there, Sandy said, keeping her eyes away from the door. They're drug addicts who never come out unless their dealer pulls up in the parking lot. When Nate arrived to 213, he unlocked the door and asked the woman, "How long have you been staying here?" There was a short silence, a look of reluctance grew on Sandy's face, and she finally replied, "Not long, about 4 days." Nate could sense that she was lying, but decided to let it go. "Well, it was nice talking to you," he said while opening the door. Sandy smiled and replied, "Oh, absolutely, and I wish your sister the best of luck with getting married." She paused for a few seconds. "I hope I get married one day, but I doubt that'll ever happen now." He then proceeded to enter the room, said his goodbyes in the threshold, and Nate shut the door. Inside 213, he peeked from behind the curtain of the window and watched Sandy walk away. What a beauty, he thought, sitting on the foot of the bed. Despite finding the woman physically nice to look at, Nate couldn't help but feel a sense of mystery to Sandy. For someone who had only been staying at the motel for 4 days, she acted like she knew the place pretty well. And another thing, why did Sandy look so hesitant when he asked her how long she'd been staying there to begin with? Whatever the reason, it didn't really matter. Come morning, Nate would be leaving, and he knew he would never see her again, so it didn't really faze him. After taking a hot shower, he stepped out of the bathroom and noticed something on the floor underneath the bed. Wearing only a towel around his waist, he bent down to examine the object and noticed it was a VHS tape. On it was a strip of masking tape with the words, "Property of Room 201, written on it in black Sharpie. A feeling of curiosity peaked inside him. Nate recalled Sandy telling him earlier that she was staying in 201. His first thought was to put on some clothes, head a couple of doors down, and return the tape. But then he thought, why would I do that? It isn't like Sandy would know anything about it. So instead, Nate figured he would stick it in the VHS player and watch the contents on the tape. After feeding the tape into the VCR and pressing play, he turned on the room's television with a remote control. At first, there was only static, but eventually that cleared up to reveal a recording outside of room 201. The person holding the camera could be heard breathing, and a hand off camera knocked on the door. A couple of seconds passed, and eventually the door opened. Standing in the threshold was Sandy. It was obvious she was trying too hard to act, and she said into the camera, "Oh, hello. How are you?" The cameraman didn't reply, and in a semi-seductive voice, she added, "Of course you can come inside, baby." "What the fuck am I watching?" Nate asked himself. It was then he noticed the date at the corner of the screen read, June 15th, 1983. A bizarre feeling of confusion covered him, and he thought, 1983? What is this? The scene's tracking then became extremely terrible, and it cut to the inside of presumably what is room 201. The camera was aimed at the bed, and on it appeared a drug-induced Sandy with a naked midget by her side. In the mirror above the headboard appeared the person holding the camera in the reflection. However, the identity of the cameraman was hidden by a plastic goat mask. Meanwhile, a crappy audio recording of Soft Cell's Sex Dwarf could be heard in the background. Sandy, the beautiful blonde woman Nate had met earlier, was also nude and drooled at the mouth. Through thick slobber, she muttered, "Something," and the midget said to the cameraman, "She's a little too disco dolly, isn't she?" The goat man could be heard breathing heavily behind his mask and in a deep and unsettling voice instructed the small person to pleasure her. After making an obscene gesture with his tongue, the midget began to fondle Sandy's nether regions while seductively saying, "Isn't it nice, sugar and spice?" Sandy moaned in both pain and unwanted sensation. When she tried to make the small man stop, he punched her in the face with his small fist. After the woman stopped struggling, the midget leaned to her face and yelled, "We're going to make you a star." The scene then cut to the miniature beast giving the woman oral sex and exclaiming how wonderful she tasted. Nate wanted to look away but couldn't bring his eyes to refrain from watching. It was a combination of disgust, mortified fear, and shock. "That's right. Eat her good," the goat man instructed. "Lure her to a life of ice." Nate couldn't move. All this color seemed to flush out onto the carpet floor and sink beneath his feet. A dark tide of repulsion churned in his stomach as the midget turned to the camera and gave a wicked and perverse smile. "You know what they say about small boys," he growled, licking his lips. The tracking then became worse and it was hard to make out what was happening. However, Nate could hear Sandy attempt to scream. After about a minute of poor quality, and the sound of the tiny monster mouthing harsh profanities, the scene cut to room 201's bathroom. On her knees, Sandy could be seen with her arms tied behind her back. When the woman tried to speak, blood poured from her mouth and it was revealed that Sandy's teeth had been yanked from her jaws. From behind her, the midget smiled at the camera and said, "She won't be biting anybody's dick anymore, that's for sure." Both he and the cameraman chuckled wickedly. Sandy moaned through her sore gums. The small man then pulled out a black trash bag and put it over her head. He began to suffocate the woman as he pulled the bag tight. The plastic morphed around her, revealing the structure of the woman's face as she struggled to breathe, and then suddenly, the TV went to static and the tape ejected from the VCR. Immediately, Nate sprung from the foot of the bed and ran down to room 201. Hell, he was so terrified that he forgot only a towel hid his nudity. When Nate got to the room, he began to frantically beat on the door. "Sandy," he panically screamed. "Open up." There came the sound of a chain unlocking and the door opened. In the threshold of 201 stood Sandy, and she asked, "What's wrong?" In a frantic state, Nate explained the contents on the video in his room, how her teeth were missing, and everything else. The woman gave him an odd look and, after 3 seconds of silence, asked, "What are you talking about?" Disoriented and flustered, Nate told the woman to come in his room and watch the tape. Scared at the sight of a half-naked man who had just spoken about her being molested and choked with a plastic bag, Sandy shut the door in his face. Nate tried knocking again but stopped when she yelled, "Go away or I will call the cops." "Well, perhaps somebody needs to," he thought as he made his way back to room 213. When Nate got inside his room, he slipped on a pair of pants, didn't bother putting a shirt on, and grabbed the VHS tape. He stormed down to the lobby, slamming the video on the front desk and demanded that the motel worker notify the police. The lobbyist looked down at the tape and said, "Jesus, I thought I got rid of this smut ages ago." Nate paused and stared at the man from behind the desk and asked, "You know about this?" "Sadly, I do," the man replied. "It features that poor woman who doesn't know she's dead." Nate felt a cold feeling in every single one of his bones and, after processing what the lobbyist said, sternly asked, "What the fuck are you talking about?" "Sandy Henderson? Room 201? Yeah, she's dead. Poor gal thought she could earn a couple of bucks making a snuff film years ago." He then paused and lit a cigarette. "She walks around this place every day, unaware that she could never leave. And what's sad is Sandy isn't the only one here." Nate then grabbed the lobbyist by the shoulders and yelled, "Stop fucking around with me, man. Call the police now." The worker pushed him off and shot back, "Easy there, Mr. Director. You can call the police all you want, but this place won't let you do it." Suddenly, Nate felt as if someone had slapped him in the face. "What did you just call me?" The lobbyist took a drag off his cigarette and exhaled the smoke. "Mr. Director. See, Sandy isn't the only soul here who doesn't know they're dead. Or that they're a nasty little pervert." He took another puff. "Back in 1983, you were traveling to your sister's wedding. The tragedy is, the beloved bride down in Georgia had no idea her brother is a total sicko, or that he died from a cocaine overdose the night after filming this timeless classic." The man behind the desk looked down the VHS tape and back to Nate, who remained silent. After a momentary pause, Nate tried to find the words to formulate a question, but couldn't bring himself to ask it. "And as for that little heathen midget," the man said, "God knows where he is. This motel is so crazy he's probably hiding in the laundry room." No, this cannot be true. This can't be true," Nate replied, trying to grasp all of what he had just been informed. "Well, it is. And you, sir, are checked into the Motel Astor." And the sad part about it is that I'm stuck here with you fucking nutcases until the day someone decides to bulldoze this place to the ground. The man then leaned down behind the desk to grab something, and it was then Nate noticed an exit wound on the back of his head. When the lobbyist rose back up, he placed a Sony Betamovie BMC200 camera on top of the desk and said, "It's still in good condition for you, if you decide to make another dirty movie, you fucking sicko." At one point, my walls were the lightest shade of pale blue, and traces of my mania can be found in the floral spiral patterns. However, after years of people smoking, they have turned nicotine yellow. I've seen it all. Dominatrix fantasies, homosexual lovers, prostitutes, sex offenders, cheating ministers, and many more. And every one of them, whether they are young or old or innocent or vile, have never escaped. While my victims drift off in between their vulnerable slumber and consciousness, I crawl inside them and cause sleep paralysis. Oh, how they struggle and try to pull themselves from my dark power. These souls beg for sweet release as I take the form of a demonic being and rape them. And the more they cry, the stronger I become. I restrict their windpipes and watch them with great glee as these fragile lambs slowly die. Imagine placing a bell jar over a butterfly and observing its struggle as oxygen depletes. Or visualize a weak worm in a scorpion's pit. I am malevolent. I am the darkness. I am a killer. But sometimes my method of murder doesn't involve depraved sex and suffocation. Take, for example, a victim I murdered back in 1999. A young man sat inside of me and contemplated taking his life. He lost his job and struggled with depression for many years prior. To add to this, the guy's boyfriend of 3 years had broken up with him. After an hour of contemplating his life and writing a suicide note, this man realized life's virtue. Love, compassion, the smell of rain, autumn leaves crunching beneath his feet, and other things that made him happy. Nevertheless, I am none of these, and I forced him to undress, sit in the bathtub, and take a switchblade to his wrists. "No, no, no," he screamed, as I made his hand cut a vertical slit into the pale belly of his left arm. As the blood drained from his cold body, the young man's final word was simply the question. "Because I can," I replied coldly. "I am savage. I am corrupt. I am evil." But in all honesty, my favorite kill was back in 1985. A married father and a hooker decided to spend the night within my walls. Between fucking the whore, he could call his wife and tell her about the business trip he'd lied about. This should be fun, I thought to myself. As the adulterer screwed the woman from behind, I possessed him. Inside the cheating husband's mind, I demanded he reach between the mattress and the box spring and obtain a knife someone left years ago. Under my control, the man gripped the blade. "Oh, baby," the greasy-haired hooker exclaimed, faking an orgasm. "Give it to me." As he steadily pulled in and out of her ass, the father of three took the blade and slashed her neck from cheek to cheek. Blood gushed from her neck and soaked the entire bed with hepatitis. And even after the sex worker's soul departed her body, I made the man continue. "I am brutality. I am malice. I am a trap." After the unfaithful lover came, I snapped my fingers and he awoke from his trance. When he discovered the crime he unwillingly committed, the man screamed and screamed and screamed. However, it was no use. Susan was dead. For the thing about my walls is that no matter how loud a person screams, nobody will ever hear them. And being that I am able to change my form, I made the door and windows disappear so the cheater could not escape. After days of being trapped with a rotting corpse, the man had gone insane from starvation and dehydration. Hell, he had even resorted to eating parts of the hooker's body and throwing feces at the ceiling. Oh, he shouldn't have done that. I decided to tie him to the bed for eternity and feed him dog food as his only meals. But no matter what happens within me, I always clean up. A forensic scientist could investigate and find absolutely no DNA evidence that someone had died. And as for those who come to the Motel Astor and check into my domain, please know that there are complimentary toothbrushes and towels in the bathroom. And note that I will fuck with your mind and reflect the pit of your worst fears, whether it hissing cockroaches, snakes, or traumatic experiences. You will come face to face with them and fall into my inescapable snare. I am destruction. I am sadism. I am every room. I am the Motel Astor. For 10 years, Maria lived in her husband's dungeon. Only this wasn't a dungeon that was underground with shackles and iron maidens and other torture devices. Instead, it was above ground in a white double-wide with plastic pink flamingos on the front lawn. Her mother had always told Marie that she had settled for less, and God was she right. If Marie did anything in the slightest that crossed her husband, there would be hell to pay. Take, for example, the macaroni and cheese incident. One day, she had cooked a generic box instead of Kraft, and before Marie could apologize, her husband threw the pasta on the floor. After being struck in the face, the beast who wore a wedding ring demanded his wife get on the floor and clean it up like a dog. "Eat it, or I will break your jaw," he growled. When Marie objected, he grabbed his partner by her strawberry blonde hair and threw her to the ground. "I told you to fucking eat it." "Please, Melvin, I'm sorry," she cried out. Although a sick part of him liked it when she begged, Melvin kicked her in the stomach and commanded Marie do as she was told. Quaking with despair, the abused doll licked the cheesy noodles off the linoleum floor and held back her tears. It infuriated Melvin when she cried, so the best thing to do was to suppress everything. After cleaning up the pasta with her mouth, Melvin dragged Marie to the bedroom and tossed his wife onto the bed. As he undressed himself, the dungeon master snapped his belt and growled, "I've been sporting a hard dick all day at this goddamn construction site," he let out a sour burp and added, "and now daddy just needs a little lovin'." Marie knew that if she were to say no to this monstrosity's desires, he would punch her in the breast again. So she took off her shirt to reveal broken skin and yellow bruises that surfaced right below the epidermis. She removed her pants, slid her beige panties down to her ankles, and in a voice that had better have sounded sweet, Marie said, "Mommy needs it." Oh, how she hated speaking like that. But Melvin wanted his doll to talk like a dirty slut. He wanted to contort its arm behind its back and use it like an object. That is, after all, what Marie was to him. A plaything, a disposal excuse, and a slave to his lust. Melvin crawled on top of her and, like an angry bee, went at her. And Marie, well, she thought of beautiful things as the smell of sex, sweat, and meaty armpits infiltrated her nostrils. She imagined another life and living in peace without the fear of being hurt by her husband. And somewhere between the pain of hard penetration and heartache, a voice inside her asked, "Then why don't you just go? Why do you stick around? You're 33 years old and the world is yours. The ocean, the mountains, the flatlands, that dungeon door is always open." After Minuteman Melvin came into what he referred to as nasty curtains, he collapsed on top of his wife and fell asleep. Under the monster's weight, the same voice asked, "What if he hits you again and that blow finally does you in? What if it's tomorrow?" Marie felt like dying, not herself entirely, but the part that had any connection to Melvin. She knew the answers to the questions spiraling within her mind and decided that she needed to leave. So the next morning, when Melvin took a shower before work, his wife went through her husband's wallet and obtained his credit card. This was a really bold and risky thing for her to do. If Melvin were to check his wallet, there would be a nuclear explosion. However, to Marie's relief, her husband didn't bother checking and put his billfold in his back pants pocket. Before he left, Melvin gave her a kiss on the forehead and said, "When I get back, it'll be round two." "No, it won't," she wanted to say. But instead, Marie told the dungeon master exactly what he wanted to hear. "Yes, Daddy, anything for you," When Melvin was finally gone, she packed two suitcases with anything that could fit. Clothes, pants, socks, underwear, jewelry, but most importantly, Marie took all the photos of her and her family and packed them as well. Prior to leaving this pain-infested shithole, she took red lipstick and wrote on the bathroom mirror, "Don't bother trying to find me." With that said and done, Marie put the suitcase in the back of her mint-green Saturn and sped away from the double-wide. Hell, she didn't even look in the rearview mirror. "What's in the past is in the past," the voice told her. "And it is no more." As she embarked on her big escape, the runaway decided she would go to her brother and his boyfriend's apartment in northern Pennsylvania. But before hitting Highway 70, Marie needed to stop by the bank. Being a signatory to her husband's account, she withdrew $2,000 from her husband's savings. Marie figured that that would be more than enough to get her to Pennsylvania. Any additional money left over she referred to as the douchebag tax. When she left the bank, Marie hit Highway 70 and turned the radio on. Either it was a coincidence or a sign from above, but the song playing was Soft Cell's Tainted Love. She turned up the music and the voice in her head sang along to the lyrics. Eventually, morning turned to evening and Marie knew by this point Melvin had discovered his credit card was missing. In between two halves, one being a scared woman and the other brave, she told herself that this meant there was no turning back. Marie knew this was all or nothing. But despite everything, even the strongest woman in the world became tired after driving for a long period of time. So she pulled into a place called the Motel Astor and decided to stay the night. The establishment wasn't exactly the Holiday Inn, but it would have to suffice. Upon parking the Saturn, she thought to herself that the place had a very mysterious feel to it. It reminded her of the motels back in Florida she stayed at as a child when her parents went to Daytona Beach. However, this motel seemed to be stripped of any fond memories. If the illuminated sign out front hadn't suggested it were still in business, Marie would have kept driving under the assumption that it was closed down. She walked to the lobby, paid a deposit for the night, and obtained a key to room 107. With two suitcases in her hand, Marie made her way to the room. But before entering, a hooker who stood outside 108 asked, "What are you running away from, dollface?" The prostitute then took a drag of her cigarette and exhaled menthol smoke. "Pardon me?" Marie asked. The hooker, who had black greasy hair and wore a Rolling Stones t-shirt, brought a jeweled hand to her lips to take another puff of the cigarette. In a cloud of smoke, she replied, "I can tell when a woman's had enough. Believe me, I've been there." I have no idea what you're talking about," Marie replied, putting down the suitcases and pulled the room key from her pocket. "Oh, please," the hooker shot back. "The bruises on your arms and that busted lip either means you just got in a fight with Frida Foreman or you've had enough of your husband's bullshit." And Marie was silent. She never thought in a million years that she'd look like one of those women, the ones you see in the supermarket with a black eye and blame it on the doorknob or the oven. "Do I really look pathetic?" she thought to herself. The grungy escort then asked, "You want to know what else gave it away?" She took a pause and then a long drag of her cigarette. "You ain't wearing a wedding ring, and I can see the pale indentation around your finger from where it was." Marie looked down at her hand and realized that this was true. Although she had taken it off miles down the road, Marie felt it as if it were still there. "You know what I think? I think you got a clit of steel," the sex worker continued. "Most women stay around and accept the life of a punching bag that wears an apron. A lot of them think they need a man, but the truth is, men need us. I mean, who would they be without someone to twist, beat, and fuck? In that order." "A lowly sack of dog shit," Marie answered, while opening the door and heading inside. But before sealing off the threshold, she looked at the hooker and shot coolly, "Let me ask you something. Why do you, of all women, think they have the nerve to open my wounds?" The hooker let out a chuckle and replied, "Oh, please, don't think you're all high and mighty up in your tower, Rapunzel. Because at least if a man hit me, I would have cut his dick off from the start." She paused for a second. "Just how long did you stick around? 2 years? 5? 10? Those words slapped Marie across the face, and with great annoyance, she slammed the door and slid the chain on the lock. Fuck her, she thought. However, she knew there was some truth to what the prostitute had said. Marie should have left ages ago, and with the crippling realization that all those years had been wasted, she fell on the bed and started to cry. But these were not tears provoked by a woman outside. This was all the rage and pain she kept inside the dungeon of her own soul. All of those moments Marie was not allowed to cry or say how she felt poured from her eyes and onto the dirty sheets of the motel bed. It had been a weight she carried for so long, and with Melvin miles away, Marie finally had the chance to let it go. "There, there," called that same voice. "At least you're gone. It's better now than never, remember that." It was then that Marie's tears then turned into salty joy, and she replied, "You're right, I did it. I finally did it." After pulling herself together, she headed to the bathroom and turned on the warm water. She figured that her first day of liberation called for a celebratory hot bath. As the water ran, Marie walked down to the Coke machine located two doors down and fed it a dollar. She selected the option for Mellow Yellow and retrieved the soda. When she got back to her room, Marie removed her clothes and headed to the bathroom. However, to her surprise, she saw that the water in the tub wasn't clear. Instead, black liquid that smelled of rot took up the bottom of the bath, and pouring from the faucet was darkness. Disgusted, Marie reached over and turned off the water. She covered her nose and exclaimed, "What the fuck?" The black lagoon disgusted her. Not only did it smell of decay, but the aroma also matched the scent of a paper mill and burned tires combined. Immediately, Marie went to the motel room's telephone and called the lobby. After two rings, the man who checked her in answered the phone and said, "Astor Lobby, how may I assist you?" "Ah, yes. This is the occupant in room 107, and I'm calling about an issue in regards to the bathtub," Marie replied, trying not to gag from the smell locked in her nasal cavity. "Uh-huh. And what seems to be the problem?" She explained how the water ran black and described the level of nastiness. Marie compared it to the appearance of rotten tar. "All right. We will send someone down in a second to see what the problem is," the man replied. After thanking him for being of assistance, Marie hung up the telephone and proceeded back to the bathroom. However, this time the water was clear as it should be. Not believing what she was seeing, Marie ran her hand through the warm water and realized that it was, in fact, there and clean. "I don't understand," she whispered, trying to make heads and tails of what was going on. Suddenly, the phone rang, causing her to jump. Before it could reach its third ring, Marie raced over and picked it up. "Hello?" she answered. "Yes, this is the lobby," said the man from before. "I'm just calling to inform you that the repairman is on his 30-minute lunch, and he'll be there in half an hour. Again, I'm sorry for the..." "Oh, well, it'll no longer be necessary," Marie interrupted. "The water's fine now. I know it sounds crazy, but I've been driving all day, and I must be seeing things." However, Marie knew what she had seen. Unless Melvin had hit her too many times in the head and she had gone insane, the water was black not long ago. But she didn't want to come off as a burden to the lobbyist and simply apologized. When the conversation ended, Marie went back to the bathroom and drained the tub. There was no way she was submerging her body in the bathwater, regardless of how clear it had become. So instead, she put on her sleep clothes and decided to lie down. Marie turned on the television to see what the weather would be like the next day, but noticed that every channel was static. She checked the cable connection and realized that it should be playing channels. Marie had thought to call the lobby again, but didn't want to continue badgering the front desk. "Well, looks like there will be no television tonight," she said, reaching for the remote and turning off the TV. She then decided to close her eyes and try to get some sleep. As she drifted off into a deep slumber, Marie found herself subjected to a disturbing nightmare. In the dream, her arms and legs were tied to the motel bed, and surrounding her were lit candles. She tried to pull herself out of the binds, but failed with each attempt. At the foot of the bed stood a naked man who looked like her husband in build. However, his face was hidden by a wool sack. "Daddy wants to fuck," the man growled. Marie began to shake from fear. It sounded like Melvin, only the voice seemed a little distorted with a demonic undertone. The man crawled on top of the bed and then grabbed her breasts. He snarled and chuckled and then said, "I'm about to rip your dirty curtains open." Marie tried to yell, but the scream felt as if it was trapped in her throat. She tried to pull away, but in addition to ropes that bound her, Marie's muscles felt like tight rubber. "Please," begged the voice inside her. "Please, God, make this nightmare stop." The man's hands moved from her breast and then began to move down south. And right at that depraved, nasty moment, the figure removed the sack from his head to reveal a face that looked like a giant picked scab. Oozing from his mouth was yellow pus and maggots, and he said, "I'm gonna fuck the pain away." Marie then pulled herself from the nightmare with a scream. She took a moment to catch her breath and repeatedly told herself it was just a dream. But what was strange is that when Marie looked at her wrists, she noticed pink rope burns. She quickly pulled the sheets off her legs to examine her ankles, and they too had the same markings. A dark feeling fell to the pit of her stomach and fear swirled within. At that moment, the telephone rang. When Marie answered the call, she could hear heavy breathing. But this just wasn't any breathing. She recognized the same pant that she had heard for the past 10 years from screwing Melvin. Immense anxiety froze over, and after about 5 seconds, Marie asked, "Why are you calling me?" Before the caller hung up, there was a deep chuckle, and Melvin's voice growled, "Check the Bible in the nightstand, baby." Marie looked over at the table beside the bed and pulled open the drawer. In it was a Bible like Melvin had said. When she opened it, she let out a scream. In the chapter of Leviticus was a bookmarking with her and Melvin's wedding photograph. On the picture written in black Sharpie read the words, "I will find you." This caused fearful tears to form in her eyes, because Marie didn't bring this photo with her on the big escape. Had Melvin been in room 107? Was he staying somewhere in the Motel Astor? How did he find her? All these questions ricocheted in her mind. Suddenly, there was a knock at the door. This practically caused Marie to piss herself, and her heart almost stopped. "Oh my God," she thought to herself. High tension pulled tight like a cello string that was about to snap. When the second knock came, Marie ran to the door and looked through the peephole. In fisheye view stood the man, but his face seemed murky. From the other side of the wood, his voice hissed. "Why did you overcook the pasta?" he growled. "Only a stupid cunt fucks up good pasta." Although she couldn't make out his face, Maria knew it was Melvin's voice. She began to cry hysterically and screamed, "Go away! Go away, Melvin, or I'll call the police!" Melvin then proceeded to bang on the door over and over. He screamed and yelled and called her every profanity known to man. His wife jumped back from the door, and at this point, tears poured from her eyes like a great waterfall. The banging and beating became louder and more violent. Hell, one would think the chain were about to snap and the door would fall in, but out of nowhere it stopped, and what followed was a deep silence. Shaking from fear, Marie looked out the peephole this time and saw no one standing there. With her sanity on edge and afraid to leave the room, she picked up the phone and dialed 911. However, the call went straight to a static sound instead of a dispatcher. Marie hung the telephone up, picked it up, and proceeded to try and contact help once more. Again, there was only static. After numerous failed attempts to get a hold of the cops, she figured she would try and contact the only other person that made her feel safe. Marie dialed her brother's number, and to her surprise, it began to call out. At two rings, her brother picked up and said, "Hello?" "Craig, oh my God, you have to help me," she spewed out into the phone. "Where have you been?" he asked. "Me and Mom have been trying to contact you all day." Marie then confessed to her brother everything. How she finally took his advice and left Melvin. How she stole his credit card and took out money. And apologized for not calling first because she didn't want to worry him and his boyfriend. And now Melvin was at the Motel Astor trying to kill her. All of this information overloaded into Craig's ear and he said, "Marie, I'm proud that you got away from that prick of a husband. But it's impossible for him to know where you are." After a short silence, Marie replied, No, I don't understand." Her brother then informed his sister that Melvin had been in a construction accident and was on life support in the hospital. "They don't think he's going to make it," Craig added. "Pablo, Mom, and I were going to ride down there in the morning to be with you." As Marie held the phone to her ear, she flipped the Bible back open and noticed the wedding photograph was nowhere to be found. In an immense state of confusion, she didn't know what to say. And if Melvin had been rushed to the hospital, then who was it that called her? also who was the man at the door. She then said in a low tone, "Craig, I need to get off the phone now." "Well, what about Melvin?" her brother asked. "They can pull the plug for all I care," she coldly replied. "I'll call you back in the morning when I figure out what to do." "Are you safe?" Craig asked. Marie honestly didn't know. Her mind felt like it was going in 500 different directions at once. She couldn't tell whether or not she had gone insane and had so many questions about everything going on around her. After telling her brother what he wanted to hear, Marie said her goodbyes and hung up the phone. In the middle of room 107, a puzzled migraine began in her head, and Marie stared fearfully at the door. "Who was that?" the voice from within asked. After a moment of silence, there came another knock. She got up and slowly walked to the closed threshold. Through the peephole this time stood the prostitute from earlier. She undid the chain, opened the door, and the hooker asked, "Is everything okay? I thought I heard screaming." In a dazed fog of uncertainty, Marie informed her that someone was harassing her. The woman smiled and replied, "Well, at least you know it isn't your husband." As she turned around and started to walk away, she added, "Some bitch should have been more careful at his job." It suddenly felt like ice water was pumping through Marie's veins. She stepped out from the doorway and asked, "Hey, how the hell did you know that?" The prostitute's black stilettos stopped in their tracks. She then turned around to reveal a deep, bloody cut in her neck and replied, "I hear everything that goes on within these walls, dollface. Nothing goes unknown." The woman then proceeded to walk down the motel sidewalk, knocking on every door as she passed along. The sight of her slit throat left a collapsed feeling of terror inside Marie's soul. She wanted to scream, but the unbelievable sight left her shocked. Needless to say, in the midst of completely losing it, Marie packed quickly, grabbed her belongings, and stuffed them in the back of the Saturn. Hell, she didn't even bother returning the room key that was in her pocket. As Marie began to pull out of the parking lot, she noticed something quite peculiar about the lobby area. On the front door was a sign that read, "Temporarily closed for renovations. We will reopen in September." And from the way the office looked, the Motel Astor had been closed for a while. It was then that Marie felt the inside of her pocket for the key to room 107 and discovered nothing. She didn't have a key to the room at all. It seemed like one moment, Roman was cuddled up next to me in bed. With our naked bodies pressed together beneath an ocean of sheets, I could hear his voice whisper, "Why are your hands so cold?" I could taste his lips, embrace his warmth, and feel his bare feet rub against mine. However, in the slumber of my morning, I would wake at 3 a.m. to discover that he still wasn't there. It had been a year since Roman had went missing, and life as I knew it felt as if it had come to a grueling end. One day he told me he was on his way home from work and that he would be home and that he wanted Chinese. But an hour passed and the food I ordered started to grow cold. I had called him at least 20 times when the clock struck 10. I dialed up his best friend, Winifred, and she told me, "No, Michael, I haven't heard from him. Is he okay?" And I replied, "I don't know." Those words were heavy with concern, like an anvil tossed into a dark sea of worry. I called the police, told them that my boyfriend hadn't come home. This turned into a missing persons report, and eventually 2 weeks went by. "We're doing all we can to find him," the police would tell me. "Are you sure he didn't have any enemies who would want him dead?" "No," I told them. But in the back of my mind, I wondered if he did. The idea of someone abducting him and hurting him killed me. And of course, there was the thought that perhaps he had run off with another man. "That doesn't make any sense," his sister would tell me, a month after hearing no word from Roman. "He had just left his office. Besides, it doesn't seem like him to just wander off with another guy if he was going to propose." She stopped. There was a silence that stuck pins in my heart. Finally, after 3 seconds of an awkward pause, Roman's sister hissed, "Fuck." Ultimately, the police told me and his family that the search was off and only the worst could be assumed. For the longest time, I didn't sleep because anxiety gave me thoughts that perhaps some maniac had scalped his curly, chestnut hair or gouged out his copper-colored eyes. Whenever I took a shower, I got down on the tub floor in the fetal position and let the steam engulf my nude vulnerability. As the water rinsed over my body, I cried for Roman and ached for him in my gut. With every passing day, a part of me that was connected to my boyfriend died. My life had turned into a consistent state of pain. I didn't want to move on, and the worst part is that there was never an end. Believe me when I say the unknown is worse than the idea of death. Winter thawed into spring, spring became summer, and the green leaves on the trees turned into vibrant oranges and reds. I didn't enjoy any of the holidays that came in and passed because I never left our apartment. I still called it our apartment. And suddenly, out of nowhere, in this vast black hole of grief, I received a phone call. On the side of the bed where Roman used to sleep, I reached over and picked up the telephone. In a voice drenched in depression, I answered, "Hello?" Light breathing could be heard, and a male voice that sounded familiar replied, "It's me." At first, I thought I was dreaming. When your life becomes nothing but a miserable coma, you can't tell the difference between what is real and what is not. For months, all I did was lay in bed, and I never washed the sheets in fear the detergent would remove Roman's scent. I shook my head a little to confirm that I was indeed awake and asked, "Who is this?" On the other side of the line, I heard the flick of a lighter and the inhale of a cigarette. And the voice said, "Come to room 205 at the Motel Astor in Benson." There was a pause, and the person seductively whispered, "I'll be waiting for you, Tiger." And with that, the conversation was ended by a dial tone. A streak of lightning shot through me because the only person in the world who called me Tiger was Roman. Without rationality, I jumped out of bed and switched from my birthday suit into boxer briefs, jeans, and an old shirt. This was what I had died 1,000 times for. A clue, a hint, a sign, something to ease my mania and, most of all, a sliver of hope. "I'm gonna find you, Roman," I thought to myself as I grabbed my keys to my truck. After putting on my boots, I stormed out of the apartment and embarked on a quest to find him. Now, you're probably wondering why I didn't immediately notify the police. Instead, try to understand why I didn't. For starters, I tried to *69 the call, but all I got was an automated recording telling me the number had been disconnected. Also, the town of Benson was a 20-minute drive outside of the city, and to be honest, I couldn't tell if this was real or just desperation. The only thing on my mind was getting to him, and God did I speed. A mix of desire, hope, and shock controlled the gears of my truck. My foot stomped the gas, and my heart raced at 70 miles per hour. The city lights dimmed, and the horizon darkened into the country night. Adrenaline rushed through my veins, and desire trembled inside me. The thought that perhaps somebody may have prank phone called me didn't even cross my mind until I saw a sign that read, "Welcome to Benson, the town where dreams come true." But if Roman really was waiting at the Motel Astor, I couldn't decide on whether or not I wanted to hug, fuck, slap, kiss, or scream at him. Where had he been? Why did he vanish? What happened? Why didn't he just come home? Was this really happening? And then it dawned on me. I didn't even know where I was going. I mean, yes, I knew where the town of Benson was, but I had no idea where this said Motel Astor was. When I entered downtown Benson, I pulled over to a diner called Henry's and parked the truck. I figured I would ask someone directions to the motel, if it even existed. In a rush, I burst through the establishment doors. Upon entering, the smell of coffee beans, waffle batter, and hash brown grease hit me in the face. The first person I saw was a middle-aged waitress. Her hair was damaged, and one could tell it had once been red. The waitress's face appeared tired due to working a late shift, and in a caring and warm voice said, "Welcome to Henry's. How may I?" "Where is the Motel Astor?" I interrupted her, practically throwing myself over the counter. My alertness seemed to startle her. When the waitress didn't respond fast enough, I shot quickly. "Can you please tell me where it is? I'm in a bit of a hurry." "Yeah, I can tell you, sugar," she replied. You look like you just stepped out of an F5 tornado. The only customer in the diner sat a couple tables away from me. He was a broad-shouldered man, bald and bearded. He took a sip of his coffee and asked, "What do you want to go to the old Astor for?" Heavy in my mouth was the entire year of suffering I had endured, my worry, my love, my damaged heart. Somehow in the clusterfuck of all the information I was trying to process, I simply replied, "Can you just tell me how to get there?" He shrugged and said, "Yeah. Just go up E Street and take a left onto Highway 70. You'll drive for about a good 10 minutes and it'll be on your right." He paused. "But you might want to take a gun with you." I looked at the man rather dumbly and asked, "What for?" "There ain't nothing but trouble out there. Meth heads, drug dealers, prostitutes. Hell, that place is practically an STD with vacancy." I didn't care. The man drinking his coffee could have told me the Motel Astor was an active volcano about to explode, and I still would have ventured there to find Roman. Without saying anything else, I left the diner, got into my Chevy, and sped to the directions I had been given. On the radio, the Golden Earrings Twilight Zone could be heard through a light static. Thoughts echoed through my mind. Why would he want me to go to a crime-infested motel? Had my lover been abducted by criminals who wanted ransom? What if this is a setup? But most importantly, was I really prepared to find out? I took a left off E Street and merged onto Highway 70. With the window down, cool phantom sheets pounded me in the face. My fist gripped the steering wheel and my foot pressed the gas. Images of Roman at the beach flashed in my mind. I recalled him exclaiming, "Hey, Tiger, take a picture of me." And images of what was to come haunted me. If Roman was really waiting in room 205, would he still be all together? Would his arms and legs be attached to his torso? Would he be physically complete the way he was when he left me? All of these questions ran through my head at 65 miles per hour down a dark highway. After a short while, I finally reached my destination, and before me in the headlights appeared a sign. In neon yellow letters, it read, "Motel Astor," and the "no" next to the word "vacancy" flickered. The building was two stories and looked as if it had been built sometime in the early 70s on an American dream that fell into hard times. Some of the windows were boarded up and the gated pool had been drained, leaving dead algae on the bottom. I parked the truck, got out, and didn't even hesitate to stop into the lobby and inquire any information about who was staying in room 205. I followed a cracked sidewalk and doors numbered 101 to 120. Each passing room increased the anxiety of what was to be discovered. At the bottom of the stairs that led to the upper story stood a grungy, female prostitute. Her hair was an oily black mess and her short magenta skirt and fishnet hose suggested a blowjob would be cheap. Her tank top, a ripped and shredded excuse that covered her braless cleavage, had the graphic design of the Rolling Stones' lips. When I tried to pass her, she struck an erotic pose and said, "I can turn a fag straight with these lips. You looking tonight, dollface?" This hooker's eyes, these two slits in her sockets smeared with black eyeliner and dollar store mascara, ogled me head to toe and searched for green so she could obtain some crack cocaine. "Get the fuck out of my way," I said, rather rude and giving her a clear indication that she was the last thing on my mind. When heading up the steps, she laughed and called back, "Your loss, pussy boy." At the second level of the building, I gulped an anvil and realized I was close to figuring out what was going on. I passed room 210 through 206 until I stood in front of the blocked threshold of a door that read 205. "There's no turning back now, Michael," I thought to myself. My hands trembled, the hair on the back of my neck and in the pits of my arms stood up and my feet went icy. I took a deep breath and knocked on the door. At first, there was no answer. I waited about 3 seconds before knocking again. At that moment, right when my knuckles were about to hit the wood, the sound of a chain unlatching from the other side could be heard. My heart dropped like an elevator down a long, dark shaft as the door opened. And standing there wasn't Roman, but instead it was a guy who almost looked identical to him. He was about the same height. His bleach blonde hair grew from a dark scalp, and his bright blue eyes gave me a cold glance. "Can I help you?" he asked with a voice that wasn't warm and inviting like my lover. He also didn't wear thick-rimmed glasses like Roman. Hell, even his style was completely different. Instead of an iron clean dress shirt, this guy wore a tank top that read Starfucker in the same font used for the Hollywood sign. His shoulders and arms fit loosely in a large leather jacket, and his pants were cut off into short shorts. I didn't know what to say at first. With my mouth open, I tried to find the words, but instead all I could do was stare aimlessly. The guy lit a cigarette, stuck his head out the door, and looked left to right. "You aren't a cop, are you?" he asked. After a short and confused pause, I replied, "No, I'm not." "Okay, well, what do you want?" he seductively purred. "Are you a bottom or a top? Or versatile?" He dropped the eroticism in his voice, then added, "I don't bear back for strangers, okay?" "What's your name?" I asked, dodging his offer. "Oh, well, it can be anything you want it to be," the guy laughed and said. "You look like a man who wants a blowjob." He put his hands on my shoulders, and it was then I couldn't take it anymore. I grabbed and shook him hard while yelling, "I'm not fucking around. What is your name?" "Jesus Christ," he exclaimed, pushing me off. "What's your problem?" I stepped back and pulled myself together and said, I'm sorry. My boyfriend went missing a while back. I got a call from someone telling me to meet them at room 205, and it sounded like him. And what's strange is you favor him tremendously." I paused for a moment and added, "Forgive me, I sound probably crazy now." The guy looked at me for a good 3 seconds and asked, "Well, what was his name?" "Roman. Roman Cardinal." The guy took a drag of his cigarette and said, "Well, that's not me. My name is Kevin Hillard. Now, do you want to have a little fun or what?" I hesitated for a moment as the disappointment of not finding my boyfriend set in. But I couldn't stop looking at Kevin and thinking of the times Roman and I used to make passionate love. I stared at Kevin's legs and jawline and felt my crotch getting tight. Perhaps he wasn't the man I was looking for, but that didn't mean he couldn't become him. "Well?" Kevin asked, as if I were an object that comes and goes. When this guy looked at me, he didn't stare avidly like Roman. Instead, he viewed me as a cash dispensary, a coin-operated pleasure unit, and dirty business. Temptation peaked inside me and I finally gave in. We exchanged saliva in the open doorway before shutting it and getting undressed. When I stared into his deceitful eyes, I tried to imagine Roman looking back at me and saying, "Do you love me?" "Yes," I replied. Kevin giggled then with a dark whisk, instructed that I screw my pain away. "Don't you just want to fuck me in this place?" And I nodded my head. "Well, the rubbers are in the nightstand along with the lube," he informed me. "Let's get this over with." I shook my head and tried to drown out his lack of self-respect. See, Roman would never do this. My lover once told me that he was my slut and only mine. Kevin positioned his nude body on the bed and I slipped on a rubber. It had been so long since I had sex that it felt new again. I covered Kevin's mouth and his tongue felt around the palm of my hand. As I ravaged this substitute for Roman, I stared my reflection in the mirror above the headrest. Looking back at me was a distortion of lust and power, and in my mind it said, "He ain't never coming back." It was all so intense that I collapsed on top of Kevin and began to lightly sob with ecstasy. Kevin then pulled away and said, "All right, it's going to be $60. As he leaned up and attempted to stand, I grabbed his arm and asked, "Where are you going?" What the fuck are you talking about? I'm going to go take a shower," he replied. On a filthy bed in a smoke-stained room, I laid naked and fragile and desperately asked, "Can I join you?" Kevin gave me a look and replied, "I mean, I guess I could, but that's an extra $10 an hour." "I don't care," I told him. As the warm water formed a hot sauna, I caressed his wet body. With my eyes closed, I rested my head on his bare shoulder and whispered in my mind, "Why did you leave me, Roman?" Kevin then hissed, "Because it became too much." I then opened my eyes and noticed the water was black and stunk of decay, I quickly lifted my head and saw that his face looked like a misleading scab that had been picked and oozed yellow pus from a slash for a mouth. My body then jolted back and I screamed. "Hey," Kevin exclaimed, "what's wrong?" When I blinked, his face in the water went back to normal. Dripping and wet, Kevin looked at me as concern was written all over him. I put my hands on the side of my head and replied, "Nothing. I don't know." My racing heart settled down and I added, "It's just been a hard year. Everything doesn't make sense like it used to." He placed his hand on my trembling shoulder and for the first time and in a compassionate voice asked, "Do you want to go lie down?" I nodded my head and replied, "Yes." After getting out of the shower, we got in bed and I spooned his nude body. Kevin snickered and asked, "Do you miss me, Michael?" After feeling a bit of hope in a warm place, something perked inside me. It was then I realized that during our entire sexual altercation that I never once told Kevin my name. I looked him straight in the eyes and asked, "How did you know that?" "How did I know what, Tiger?" he asked, placing seductive emphasis on the last word. I then rose from the bed and gave him a fearful look and demanded that he tell me who he was. Kevin reached over to the nightstand beside him and lit up a Marlboro Red 100. After exhaling smoke, he said, "Michael, I am the fear for which you keep running back to. I am the need in you for more." Kevin took another drag of his cigarette and added, "I am that feeling you deny, that voice that curls up inside your head. The manifestation of everything you want, the remnants of time you will never get back, and the guilt that rips you to pieces." "No," I thought, turning backwards inside of myself. "Every day you push it further back, hoping it isn't true," he continued. "You always come running back in the pit of your subconscious, praying I can undo everything and heal your wounds. Hell, you even worship me. But Michael, I'm not Jesus. I can't wash your feet and cleanse you of what's been done. I am not your salvation and I am not your answer. I am just a recreation of what's been destroyed." I began shaking. My mouth went dry and my throat became tight. I asked him what he meant. Kevin exhaled smoke and then continued. "You murdered Roman Cardinal." Those words made everything around me stand still. Gravity pushed down on my shoulders and the world grew 1,000 times heavier. I quickly shot back. "That ain't fucking true." "It's not?" Kevin asked. "Then explain this." He reached under the bed, pulled out a newspaper, and tossed it on top of the sheets. In big, bold letters, the headline read, "Homosexual Dispute Leads to Murder." On the front page was a picture of me, handcuffed and being walked out of the Motel Astor by two police officers. I skimmed the article and the words "argument," "breakup," "kitchen knife," "blood," and "psychotic breakdown" stuck out at me. Each one hit me in the face and caused me to want to vomit. "But it's okay, Tiger," Kevin purred. "I'm here in your head. I'm the slut in your bed. You can fuck your sorrow away. I don't mind." I started to put my clothes back on and yelled at him. "This isn't true. None of this is true." "Oh? And where do you think you're going?" Kevin asked. "Are you going to run away again?" I buttoned my shirt, slipped on my shoes, and grabbed the keys to my truck. I then proceeded to leave room 205, but the only problem is the door wouldn't open. Over and over, I tried to turn the handle, and each time the lights in the motel room flickered. A distorted and almost demonic voice from behind me growled, "Come on, Michael. Come back to bed." I turned around. I did not see Kevin, but a naked, bloody Roman with stab wounds all over his body. Blood poured from his mouth and fear rose to the top of my lungs. I let out a scream. "Go away," I yelled, frantically trying to escape. Eventually the door opened and I ran out as fast as I could. I then made my way down the steps. The female hooker who had offered me a sexual favor before was still there, only her face appeared like the hallucination I had seen in the shower. And she yelled, "You're a murderer, Michael." Tears streamed down my face as I made my way to the truck. I got inside, cranked it, and sped out of the motel parking lot. As I sped down Highway 70, A pair of oncoming headlights illuminated the inside of the Chevy, and I noticed that my hands were covered in blood. Through the static on the radio came a twisted voice that snarled, "You can't run from this. It's already been done. It's already over." In a manic state, I could barely control my driving. I veered off into the other lane, and another pair of headlights blinded me. Everything went white, and then I woke up in a sterile room. In a cold sweat, I let out a shriek, and the door to my room opened. A man dressed in eggshell blue scrubs, the same one I saw in Henry's Diner, came to hold me down. I squirmed violently as he and another man held my arms and legs. Behind them entered a woman, holding a syringe. This woman looked like the waitress, and she said, "Michael, calm down. It was just another dream." Through the aggression of trying to pull away, I caught a glimpse of one of the men's name tags. It read Kevin Hilliard. "Please," I screamed. "I want Roman. I need him." The woman, who I now realized was a doctor, stuck me with the needle and pushed down. A cool feeling coursed through my veins and calmed me down. In the spiraling vortex of both confusion and realization, I sunk inside myself and passed out. Hours later, I awoke to straps around my ankles and wrists. Beside me sat the doctor, who asked, "Are you going to continue to be a handful, Michael?" "Where am I?" I asked, ignoring her question. The doctor informed me that I was at Dorothea Dix, a mental hospital for the criminally insane, and that I was being held here to see if I was fit to stand trial. Unlike the waitress I imagined at Henry's Diner. The doctor's voice was cool and to the point. "What trial?" I asked. "The trial that determines whether you are guilty or innocent," she told me. "You have been charged with the murder of your boyfriend." No, I don't understand," I replied, trying not to cry. "The police apprehended you at the Motel Astor in Benson after discovering Roman Cardinal's blood in your apartment," the doctor said. "It is believed you disposed of his body and were on the run. However, you keep saying you didn't do it, despite the neighbors' testimonies that they heard a loud dispute next door and, like I said before, the blood." She paused for a few seconds. "They even found the knife in room 205 where you were hiding out." I tried not to cry, but through snot and sobbing, I asked, "Why would I do that?" "Well, Roman's sister informed the police that he was going to break up with you," she continued. "After putting two and two together, investigators have decided you murdered him because he broke your heart." I then recalled the night Roman came home from my work. I had gotten down on one knee and asked him to marry me. I expected to see the glimmer of excitement in his eyes, but instead there was a look of rejection. "Michael," he said to me, "we need to talk." Those words have never meant anything good. He then proceeded to tell me that we should be friends, and this has become too much. With a look of shock on my face, I asked, "I don't understand. I thought we were in love." "We were in love," Roman told me. "At least I was in love. Don't get me wrong, Mike. You're an amazing man, and I will always, always love you. But just not like that." I stood up, met his eyes, and asked, "Why are you doing this to me?" Roman's copper eyes watered up behind his glasses and, in a voice clear as day, said, "I don't want to do this, honey. As a matter of fact, it's the last thing I could possibly ever want to do to you. The sad truth is I no longer love you like I used to, and, believe me, I don't want to see you in pain. In the shadow of everything we have overcome, the light simply isn't there anymore, and I'm sorry." I was quiet for a moment, gritted my teeth, and asked him, "It's your coworker, Michelle, isn't it?" A stray tear dripped from his puffy eyes. He didn't say anything, but it was completely obvious what the answer was. "And does she know you're with me?" I hissed, beginning to slowly unravel. "Does Michelle know that you and I sleep together?" He gulped and sternly replied, "I told her you were my best friend. I told her we were just roommates. And I told her you were like my brother." "Brothers don't fuck each other," I yelled, and this caused Roman to jump. My heart, my ginormous heart that I had poured out to him when I was naked, started to slowly break into 1,000 pieces. "You want this to be easy for me?" I screamed. "I don't remember exactly doing it. But the next thing I knew, there was a kitchen knife in my hand, and Roman's throat had been slashed open. With both hands, he covered his severed throat, and blood flowed between his fingers. When he fell to the floor, I got on top of Roman and stabbed him over and over again, yelling profanities and crying uncontrollably. And that's what happened, I told the doctor, snapping back to reality in the present day. I wanted him to love me, and if Roman couldn't love me, then he couldn't live, and I wasn't going to live without him. After the doctor left the hospital room, I closed my eyes and heard a voice seductively say, "Do you miss me, Tiger? If you do, then come on home to the Motel Aster. We'll be waiting for you."